If you have a Bible, maybe you'd have it open at Luke chapter 15, and we were working through this very well-known story together. It's been called the greatest story ever told, actually. It's not difficult to see why, is it? The story of the prodigal son is the stuff of soap operas, isn't it? The more you look at it, the more you examine it. Oh, a family in turmoil, a wayward son, scandal and disloyalty, wild living, self-indulgence and corruption, bankruptcy and ruin, reunion and forgiveness, all spiced up with a generous dash of bitterness and revenge at the end. It really is the sort of stuff that glues millions every day of the week to the soaps, isn't it? But actually, the soap opera story that Jesus introduces us to in Luke chapter 15 is actually part of a trilogy, a mini-series, if you like, and he aims it very deliberately at the audience who had gathered around him to listen. In verse 1 of chapter 15, Luke tells us, now the tax collectors and, inverted commas, sinners, were all gathering around to hear him. But the Pharisees and the teachers of the law muttered, this man welcomes sinners and eats with them. Looking at those verses, the crowds that were listening to Jesus were made up of two groups, weren't they? Those who were outwardly religious and respectable, the Pharisees and teachers of Jewish law, and those who were outwardly sinful, the tax collectors, those labelled sinners by the religious elite, the tax collectors, the prostitutes, the beggars, those regarded as sinful by society and particularly by these religious bigwigs. And in verse 2, the first group of people can't understand why Jesus is hanging around with the second group of people. They mutter that to themselves, don't they? This man welcomes sinners and eats with them. They can't understand what Jesus is doing as a respectable rabbi hanging around with sinners. And in one sense, they were right. Jesus did hang around with these sorts of people, much more than he did the Pharisees and the religious elite, if we might call them that. The tax collectors were Jewish citizens working for the occupying Roman force. And as a perk of the job, it was well known that they were allowed to charge more tax than was necessary and keep the change. And so they were regarded as disloyal. They were regarded as traitors to their own people, working with the occupying force. They were seen as outcasts. A few chapters later, Jesus meets with one of them, a guy called Zacchaeus. And as a result of meeting with Jesus, Zacchaeus is completely changed. But part of that change is he gives back all the money that he cheated from people. These were the sort of characters that they were, and Jesus was hanging around with tax collectors. The beggars in those days were forced to steal and thieve in order to survive. And prostitutes certainly made no secret of their sinful practices, did they? But for Jesus, the very openness of the sin of these folk gave him a compelling reason to spend time with them. Because there was no pretense here. There was no facade. There was no religious veneer. These folk were very open, and their sin was very public, and so they knew that they were miles from God. Jesus once said, it's not healthy who need the doctor, but the sick. I've not come to call righteous people right people, but sinners. He said he hadn't come for people who thought they were okay. He'd come for people who knew they were spiritually lost and in need of God's forgiveness. And so to both expose the religious hypocrisy of the Pharisees and to reveal the heart of God for men and women who are far from him, Jesus tells these three connected parables in Luke chapter 15, each of which portray the loss of something precious and the joy of something being found. In the first part, verses 1 to 7, Jesus tells the story of a shepherd who seeks out a lost sheep that's wandered away from the fold. In the second part, verses 8 to 10, Jesus tells the story of a woman who searches high and low until she finds a precious coin that's been lost. And in the third part, Jesus tells the story of a loving father who welcomes back a son who has deliberately walked away from him. And it's the father who is the focus of the story. We often call it the parable of the prodigal son. Actually, it's the father who is the focus here, as we're going to see. And it's this concluding part of his Lost and Found mini-series, or home and away, if you want to call it that, that we're going to be focusing on this morning. Because it's here that we most clearly see what God is like and how he responds to people who are miles away from him, and by implication, how those of us who are Christians should respond to those who are miles away from him as well. So with that in mind, let's take a closer look at the three scenes in this parable of the forgiving father. As the opening credits finish, as it were, the first scene we're shown is a son's discontent. A son's discontent. Verse 11. Jesus continued, "There was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, 'Father, give me my share of the estate.' So he did, divided his property between them. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living." As the scene opens, we're presented with a father with his two boys. And he's a father that they can be justifiably proud of. He's made a success of the family business, and his two sons have bright futures ahead of them as a result. They're destined to be major shareholders and company directors when their father dies and they inherit the lot. Now, to be accurate, the law stated that the eldest son would receive a double portion of the inheritance because he was obligated to carry on the estate, the family business, if you like. But the 33% share that the younger son would have been given would have been more than enough to secure his future. But it seems that these two sons saw things very differently. The elder of the two seemed content with his lot. Seemed content. But for whatever reason, the younger son nurtured rebellion and discontent within his heart. He had enough. He wanted his share of the money. He wanted out. Now, why he felt like that, we're not told. Perhaps he reacted against the expectations of his father to continue in the family business. Perhaps he lacked a sense of direction to his life. His older brother was going to run the estate. What about him? And perhaps he just couldn't face the prospect of answering to his brother for the rest of his life and working within his shadow. We just don't know why. But for whatever reason, bitterness and discontent grew in his heart, which very soon led to open confrontation with his father. And you can imagine the scene, can't you? As he bursts into his father's office and demands his share of the business. "I can't wait any longer, Dad. I want what's coming my way and I want it now." You can imagine the scene, can't you? The high drama of that moment. Now, it wasn't unheard of in Jesus' time for a father to divide up the family estate before he died. There was provision made for that within the law. Jewish law permitted property to be passed on to heirs before the father's death. But, here's the caveat. The income from the land was still due to the father as long as he lived. And that's why what the younger son did here was so awful. Because his request to liquidate his portion and leave his father amounted to grave disloyalty and rebellion. He was saying, in effect, "Dad, I want to live as if you're dead. I want my independence. I want to be free of you and all my obligations to you. I want to be my own master. I wish you were dead." It was an astonishing act of betrayal. And that's confirmed by the fact that as soon as he got his money, what do we see him doing? He's out of there, isn't he? As far away as he can possibly get, a distant country, as far away as he can get from his father, as he possibly can. How awful, we can be tempted to say. How tragic, what a shameful way to act. What an appalling way to treat such a loving father. That can be our reaction, can't it? But you know, the Bible says that by nature, each one of us treats God exactly the same way. Let me ask you this morning, are you living as if God is dead? You shouldn't have to think too hard to answer that question. Look at the younger son. Is God someone who's irrelevant to you? He has no influence on your actions or on your day-to-day life at all. In fact, when you come to think about it, you don't welcome his intrusion. I want to run my life my way. I don't want anyone telling me how to run my life. I value being my own master. I want my independence. Nobody's going to tell me how to to rule my life. No one's going to be boss over me. Then if you think like that, can I say you're living as if God is dead? In many ways, you're just like this younger son. You're miles and miles and miles away from him. And actually, the hard truth is the Bible says that rather than God being the one who's dead, you are. Dead to God. Dead to what life is really all about. You see, the Bible says that if you're living as if God is dead, if you're far from him, if you're miles away from him, then the Bible actually describes you as being dead spiritually. Dead to God, dead to what life is all about. Writing to Christians in Ephesus, the Apostle Paul said this, "Once you were dead because of your disobedience and your many sins." But isn't it ironic that in order to go his own way and be independent, the younger son had to first be dependent on a gift from his father, his share of the estate. And you know, that's just like us humans, isn't it? We absurdly think we can live without God, and yet the mouth that uses God's name as a swear word is dependent on him for its very next breath. The mind that chooses to believe there is no God relies on him for its ability to function. The will that lives as though God were dead can only work within the boundaries of God's plan, because he's ultimately the one who controls history. You see, no matter how we may try and convince ourselves that we can rebel against God's authority in our lives, we cannot escape the fact that our very next breath, our very existence, is down to him. Do you notice the father doesn't stop the son leaving home? He could have. He could have, you know, it wasn't just a small semi-detached house on, you know, this would have been a big estate with a perimeter and lots of servants. Could have stopped him leaving. And can we say, in the same way, God will not stand in our way if we choose to live in rebellion from him. If you want to live as if God is dead, he will let you. But like this younger son, he will also allow us to live with the consequences of our choice, being far from him now and ultimately one day in eternity as well. This first dramatic scene then in the parable of the forgiving father, a son's discontent mirrored in so many of the way we react to God. But things get worse in the second scene in Jesus' parable, because secondly we see here a son's descent. Scenery changes midway through verse 13. We leave the family home and go on location with the younger son to a distant country. What was life like away from his father? What was it like living as if his father was dead? Well, we read about that in verse 13. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. After he'd spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country, who sent him to his fields to feed pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. In the space of a few weeks, the son experienced two very different lifestyles. Life at the top, and then life at the bottom. Now, life at the top was great. Has to be said, doesn't it? He'd broken free at last. He could do what he wanted. We're told in verse 13, he squandered his wealth. That word squandered in the original literally means scattered. He'd scattered his wealth. He was wildly extravagant. He went to every party there was. He did it all to excess. Wine, women and weed. The whole lot. No holds barred. Out with the old banger, in with the Ferrari. You can imagine the scenes, can't you? He was wildly extravagant. He scattered his wealth. And he had lots of friends as a result, no doubt. Drinks all round every night. He had a wild time. And do you think he enjoyed himself? Absolutely. He no doubt had a wonderful time. He had a fantastic time. Because let's not kid ourselves. It's possible to have a great time living as if God doesn't exist. It really is. The Bible says that if we're not following God, we can go ahead and gratify the cravings of our sinful nature. No holds barred. Away with this idea that sin isn't fun. We wouldn't be doing it if it wasn't, would we? Of course it's fun. for a time, for a time, until we hit rock bottom, until we have a crisis. And that's just what happened to the younger son, wasn't it? He lived it up, he scattered all he had, and then life at the top rapidly became life at the bottom. He lost his money, his friends, and before long his dignity as well. A severe famine chose that moment to sweep throughout the land, and in order to survive, he had to sell the only thing he had left, himself. And he ended up right on the bottom rung for a Jew, feeding pigs. It couldn't have got any worse for a Jew. The Jewish proverb at the time stated, "Cursed is he who feeds swine." And that's so apt, isn't it, to where this younger son got. It would have been the last job left for a Jew. For a Jew, it was the worst possible job. Pigs were regarded as unclean animals. And so even if he'd wanted to, he couldn't have entered a synagogue because he'd been in a state of perpetual uncleanness. He couldn't have got any lower. He must have been desperate. And at this point, Jesus says some very significant words at the end of verse 14. "And he began to be in need." He began to be in need. Before, he had a need in the world that couldn't be met with money. But now, he was in a crisis. He felt his need keenly. You see, it's great to live as though God doesn't exist until we're brought face to face with the reality that we are not self-sufficient. And so often it's a crisis that brings us to that point. It might be the death of someone close. It might be financial hardship. It might be the loss of a job. It might be family or marriage difficulties. It might be an illness we just can't shake off. It might be some terrible, shocking news. And suddenly we're brought low. And suddenly we realise we haven't got all the answers. And suddenly we are faced up to the fact that life is more than just work and play. And suddenly we realise we cannot go it alone. And suddenly we realise we have deep-seated needs that have been masked by how good life has been to us. And when we hit that crisis, suddenly we are faced up to the fact we have spiritual needs. Yes, we have needs physically for warmth and food and good health. Yes, we have needs emotionally for love and security and companionship. But the deepest need is a need spiritually, to be in contact with the God who created us. And that's where the younger son got to. At last, we read, he came to his senses. He realized he couldn't live without his father. Let me ask, have you realized that yet? If you realize you cannot live without God, that you were made to know him, that you were made to have fellowship with him, to be in contact with him, that is how dignified he created us. The human race's dignity is we were made to know God. Anything less than that is a tragedy. Anything less than that is life in the pigsty. But the great message of this parable is that for even the most far-off person, for even the most distant person, it is possible to have a life away from the pigsty, a path back from the distant country. And it involves doing what the younger son did. Look at verse 17. "When he came to his senses, he said, 'How many of my father's men have food to spare, and here I am starving to death. I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired men.' So he got up and went to his father." Do you notice? The son didn't think even for one minute that his father wouldn't accept him back. Didn't cross his mind. Or maybe not as a son, but he knew his father's character. He knew he wouldn't be turned away. No matter how rebellious he'd been, no matter how much hurt he'd caused, he knew he'd be welcomed back. He knew his dad. The same is true of God. No matter how you've lived, no matter what you've done, no matter how blatantly you may have rejected God, no matter how much you may have pushed him out of your life, he will welcome you back with the open arms of a loving father if you come the way this younger son did. turning your back on your old life, living as though God were dead, asking his forgiveness for the wasted years. And he will forgive, because that's his nature. God is a forgiving father who loves to welcome home returning prodigals. Because that's what we see in the last scene in this story. A father's delight. A father's delight. We have no idea how long the younger son had been away from his father. Perhaps it was months, perhaps it was years. And you know, I'm glad we're not told. I really am. Because we can never have the excuse that we've been away from God too long to turn to him again. To turn back to him. But we do know that even while he was still a long way off, his father had been waiting and watching and spotted that figure in the distance walking towards the house. And when his father saw him, his heart skipped a beat. Let me read those moving verses from verse 20 onwards again. And if you know you are far from God this morning, put yourself in the picture. Verse 20. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him. Literally, it says there, he draped himself on him and kissed him. The son said to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. There he is going through what he'd learned, what he'd practiced all the way home. But the father interrupted him. He said to his servants, quick, bring the best robe, put it on him, bring a ring on his finger, sandals on his feet, bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He's lost and is found. And they began to celebrate. Wow, what a party that must have been. There isn't even a hint of bitterness. There isn't even a hint of reproach. There's no wagging finger. There's no I told you so. There's nothing there like that, is there, here? Rather, to the son's surprise, I am sure, he ran. He threw his arms around him. He showered love and forgiveness on him. And do you notice? Everything the prodigal lacked in the distant country was lavished on him in abundance by his father. What he lacked when he was away from his dad provided in abundance, more than he could imagine. At the end of verse 16, we read that when he was in the distant country, no one gave him anything. That's what life was like in the distant country. Survive for yourself. No grace in the distant country. When he returned to his father, he had more than he could have hoped or imagined. In the distant country, he'd been starving. When he got home, his father cooked him a cow. That's pretty good, isn't it? What a contrast. In the distant country, he'd been in desperation. But his father's house resounded to the sounds of celebration. In the distant country, he'd lived in a pigsty. But his father welcomed him into the family home. In the distant country, his clothes had been soiled and stained. But his father threw a robe of honor around him, dignified him again. In the distant country, he'd been deserted and alone. But his father ran to him and draped himself on him, threw his arms around him, and called him this son of mine. Imagine the reunion. Imagine the father looking out over the fields day after day, longing to see a familiar sight of his son coming again. Imagine him spotting one day a lone figure making his way down the road. He stares with increasing excitement and notices the rags on his back and the disheveled nature of this figure as it slowly approaches, trudges towards the house. There's something familiar about the swing of his steps, the lines of his body. He's something familiar. I recognize that character. Every feature has been treasured in his memory, has been wept over many times during the years of absence. Well, it looks like, if I'm not mistaken, that has the impression, is that who I really think it is? You can imagine the thoughts going around in his mind. That's my boy! My boy's back! And what does he do? He races out of the house, down the road, the dust, as it were, flying behind him, his robes flying behind him. He grabs his son, despite the overpowering smell of the pigsty, which for a Jew would have been so repulsive. He drapes himself on him. He gives him a bear hug of an embrace. He swings him around like he's a young boy again. He kisses him as only a parent can. He yells in delight for his servants to come and reinstate this bedraggled figure as his son again. His prayers have been answered. His son is alive. His son is home. He was dead but is alive. He was lost. Now he's been found. You know, in Bible times, patriarchs didn't run. It was considered undignified. But this father doesn't care about decorum or dignity, does he? His boy is home and he cannot contain his delight. And that is exactly how God feels when someone comes to him for forgiveness. Do you get that picture of that father? That is exactly how God feels when someone comes to him for forgiveness. There is no finger wagging. There is no reproach. There is no I told you so's. Rather, he wraps those who come to him in an embrace of grace. He says, for this one of mine was dead and is alive. He was lost, but he's been found. It'd be great if it finished at that point, wouldn't it? That would have been a great happy ending. But of course, there's a sour note at the end of the parable, isn't there? And actually, the sour note at the end is the point of the parable. Because the father's grace is too outrageous for one of the family, the older brother. The fact that Jesus welcomed sinners was a problem for the outwardly respectable and religious Pharisees. As we saw, verses 1 and 2, they labelled them sinners. They said, why does this guy hang out with sinners like this? Why does he hang out with these sort of characters? And their attitude is reflected in the older brother's reaction. When he hears the sounds of celebration, when he's told that his father has accepted and welcomed back the younger son, he is furious. Look at verse 28. The older brother became angry and refused to go in, so his father went out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father, look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed you, your orders, yet you never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours was squandered, your property with prostitutes comes home, you kill the fattened calf for him. His words are very revealing, aren't they? At the beginning of the story, we would have said that he was the loyal one, wouldn't we? He looked like the loyal one. He was the obedient one. He looked the part, said the right things, did the right things. But now he blows his top. He reveals what's really in his heart. That he'd seen himself as a slave, not a son. That his obedience had sprung from duty, not love. Your orders is what he says to his father. And here's the crunch. That he wasn't really prepared to accept his father's authority. Do you notice he refused to obey his father's request to come and join the party? He says, no, I am not going to obey you. I am not going to do what you say. I do not respect your authority. He just couldn't accept the fact that entrance into his father's household was on the basis of grace alone. You see, that was the older brother's problem. He thought he could earn his father's love by his obedience and hard work and sense of duty. Just as the Pharisees of Jesus' time and so many people today think they can earn God's favour by being religious, doing religious duties, by outward respectability. And yet when his father welcomed back his younger son, he realized that his father's love was based on grace, not on the timesheet. And he just couldn't accept that. It offended his pride. And so at the end of the parable, one prodigal is replaced by another. It's really the story of two prodigal sons. But at the end of the story, while one is welcomed back into the father's house and forgiven and reinstated as a son, the other refuses his father's invitation, remains outside as far away from his father as his younger brother had ever been, calling himself a slave, not a son. Can I ask you, which son are you this morning? Do you think God should accept you because you're religious and you're outwardly respectable and you come to church? Don't fall into that trap, please. Because the sting in this tale is that those who think they're good enough for God are actually those who disqualify themselves from God's family. Because God doesn't welcome us on the basis of what we do, None of us are good enough for God. We all, like the younger son, by nature, we are all miles away from God. No, he accepts those who come to him, whatever we've done, however we've lived, however we've treated him, on the basis of grace, on the basis of his character as a loving, forgiving father. Because of Jesus, he can show grace to you this morning. Because of Jesus, who left his father's home in heaven, not aimlessly or selfishly like his prodigal, but in obedience to his father, to give himself for lost people like you and me. Because of Jesus, we can be forgiven and welcomed by God. On the cross, Jesus paid off all our debts from a distant country. He took them upon himself in our place. And so now God is able to embrace us as sons, with all the rights that go with that, if we come to him in sorrow for the way we've lived, asking for his welcome and forgiveness. I wonder, will you do that this morning? Maybe you've already done that. Isn't it wonderful, the grace of God? Maybe you haven't. Why not ask him this morning, come to a forgiving father, whatever has happened in the past, however you've treated him, whatever the fall has been, come back to a father who will not point the finger, who will not reproach, who will not say, I told you so. But if we come with repentance in our hearts, will welcome us with the embrace of grace. I don't know how far away from God you are right now, but please hear the lesson of this parable. He longs to welcome home prodigals.